Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Floods will come, all comes undone. We get kicked out of denial.
Oh, no!
At the recent climate conference, the rules were just shut up. Inside, news reporter Bob Berwin speaks with Alex Wise, host of Sea Change Radio. It's disturbing stuff. Hurricane seasons are twisting out of shape. We get new science from Dr. Josme Lopez of NOAA. American Senator Sheldon Whitehouse gives us the real news from COP29. He says climate action is going ahead all over the world, cannot be stopped, even in America. Is it too late for denial? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Activists! No voices! Just home in designated spaces!
Is this sci-fi? Nope. Those are the rules at COP29, the climate conference, recently in Baku, Azerbaijan. Longtime environment reporter Bob Berwin was there for Inside Climate News. He reported the real news from the COP in this 13-minute selection from Sea Change Radio.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's people every day here telling me stories about their islands where their wells are full of salt water, where they can't grow food anymore, where their, you know, their shoreline communities are being flooded, and then go into these sort of glitzy reception and pavilion areas where people are backslapping each other and making deals and smiling and drinking espressos. I mean, there's hundreds of booths and everyone has its own little espresso stand, and you know, it feels like a business convention.
Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Azerbaijan. For 3 years in a row now, the United Nations has chosen to hold its flagship environmental meeting, the UN Conference of the Parties, or COP, in a country largely dependent on oil revenues for its economic well-being. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Bob Berwin of Inside Climate News, currently in Baku, Azerbaijan, covering COP29. We examine the problems associated with holding this ever-expanding event in a petrostate, discuss the logistics behind the selection, and consider the key takeaway policies from the conference. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bob Berwin from Inside Climate News. Bob, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Hello, Alex, and thanks for having me back again. I appreciate it.
Well, it's always a pleasure. I wish there'd be better news. As an expat based in Austria, you have a different perspective, a unique perspective on the American political process, and it's been a very difficult one for all of us to deal with. But we're not going to talk about that moving forward on Sea Change Radio as much as possible. It's just too depressing. So let's focus on something else depressing, which is last time we had you on, I don't know if it was the last time we had you on, but we did talk to you last year when you covered the COP28 conference, the United Nations Climate Change Summit in Dubai. This year, it's in another petrostate, not that far from it. It's in Azerbaijan. And this one might be even more depressing from what I've been reading about it from your coverage. Set the stage, if you will, for what this conference means and what the message is coming from the United Nations having it hosted by Azerbaijan.
Sure. Depressing is probably a good word. Saddening is another good word. It is the third year in a row that the conference has been hosted in an oil-dependent petrostate with authoritarian tendencies. So there were concerns going in about restrictions on civil liberties and dissidents of the government here being imprisoned, and quite some restrictions on protests. You probably recall that some past COPs there have been fairly large demonstrations in the streets of the host cities, really with thousands of people turning out. That's been kind of ratcheted down the last 3 years to the point that this year demonstrators are only allowed inside the blue zone, the so-called blue zone of the conference, which is for the duration of the event, is designated as United Nations territory. So the United Nations rules apply rather than the host country laws. But even in that space, at yesterday's main demonstration by civil society, which is here represented by hundreds of environmental groups and various types of citizen groups, they weren't allowed to do their regular chants and so on. So when they had their main demonstration yesterday, they were restricted to sort of humming and snapping their fingers. That was the only thing that the host country would permit in its agreement with the United Nations. And those folks saw that as a, you know, again, as another new restriction on their ability to get their messages of concern about the escalating climate crisis to the delegates and to the negotiators. Not that those folks are not aware of those concerns anyway, but this has been sort of an important part of this ritualized process. And it was really sad to see yesterday. And, you know, many of the demonstrators had put tape over their mouths to sort of symbolize that silencing. And it was really tough to see. And talking to them and interviewing them after the demonstration, it was, a lot of us were near tears.
Where are these demonstrators from generally?
They're literally from all over the world.
So people are flying in from all over the world to protest, and yet they're muzzled, essentially.
Correct. Yes.
We read a lot about and we hear a lot about greenwashing and sports washing from these petrostates, where they'll build a big stadium to host a soccer tournament, etc. It seems like the United Nations COP conferences have become part and parcel with these big sports events or things like that. There's not a huge revenue stream for hosting a conference like this compared to like the World Cup, I'm imagining. So it's more of a big picture greenwashing for a fossil fuel dependent nation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that that's been correct the last several years with the COP, the last this year and the two previous years. And I hear what you're saying about sports events. Totally agree with that, with the World Cup in Qatar. And some of these big sports, international sports organizations are, you know, very money-oriented. And as we're starting to see right now, there's a very direct connection between emerging authoritarianism and the sort of extreme neoliberal capitalism that has developed over the last few decades. Yeah, I don't think there's a huge amount of money to be made on a COP, but it does, the host countries can use it. And Dubai last year was a great example of this, to try and show that they are sustainable and on board with global climate efforts, even if they're not. Dubai is clearly not. It's planning to increase fossil fuel production for the foreseeable future. They were trying to make oil deals while the conference was going on. But to, you know, to casual observers in other countries, you know, they might look at this and say, sort of like he described, wow, well, this climate conference is going on in Azerbaijan, so, you know, they must be on board with this. And they're not. You know, the country's president said in his opening speech at the conference that fossil fuels are a gift from God and that they plan on using them and developing them and exporting them as long as they can. I mean, he didn't beat around the bush.
So one could look through rose-colored glasses and see these oil-rich nations making a play for the environmental movement to be grouped with sustainability-leading countries around the globe. In an optimistic glass half full kind of way, one could look at this and say, oh, well, you know, deep pocketed countries need to be on board with climate change solutions. Just like people have said, well, oil companies have a lot of money. Eventually, they're going to be able to be leaders in the sustainability space. They're going to be building the wind farms and solar farms of tomorrow. It seems like a very Pollyannish view, but I'd like to hear your perspective on that comparison.
Yeah, I mean, and those two go hand in hand, and I think both parts of what you said are accurate. I was at the OPEC booth yesterday in the delegates pavilion area to do an interview with somebody. And what they highlight is their financing of development efforts and their assistance to developing countries with economic development and so forth. And they see that as their main role in this. And their newest twist now is to focus on things like hydrogen energy, which is derived from natural gas in most cases. From fossil gas, I should say. I need to stop using that term natural gas. It's fossil gas.
Yes, I remember reading Bill McKibben's piece on that. We're like, we need to stop calling it natural gas.
It's so hard to get out of that. I mean, they sold us that word. And when I write, obviously, I have a chance to reflect, and I never use it. But in conversation, it slips out.
Well, if you use fossil gas, some people might not actually know what you're talking about because it really hasn't become part of the lingua franca.
Yeah, but there has been this sort of inclusionary vision of the UNFCCC from the very beginning to say that if we're going to have a durable, sustainable agreement, everybody needs to be at the table and buy into it. And that's one of the reasons it's taken so long. Yet at the same time, when you start to see outright obstructionism and ongoing obstructionism, and you know, we can go ahead and single out Saudi Arabia, because as a researcher who wrote a paper on this told me last year, they don't care about criticism because it's a totally authoritarian state. So they don't really care what anybody thinks or says. You know, they're just going to do their thing and promote fossil fuels as long as the rest of the world allows them to do that. And so if I could pivot a little bit, there are renewed calls for COP reform right now, which is encouraging to me. It's something I've written about quite a bit for Inside Climate News. And just a couple of days ago, a pretty illustrious list of folks, including top climate scientists, the former head of the UNFCCC, Christiana Figueres, who led the organization preceding and up to adoption of the Paris Agreement, which is kind of the, you know, the high point of this process, signed on to the letter and said, this is really no longer fit for purpose, and we need to change this in some way to make more progress on reaching the global goal of limiting warming to, you know, as close to 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial baseline as possible. And we're already there, actually, now. You know, we're right at that threshold with 2024 projected to be the first year that the global temperature reaches that sort of red line. And if I can just add on to that, you know, my frustration has grown each year, and so has my sadness, because it's hard emotionally to talk to people that, you know, are struggling. I mean, there's people every day here telling me stories about their islands where their wells are full of salt water, where they can't grow food anymore, where their, you know, their shoreline communities are being flooded, and then go into these sort of glitzy reception and pavilion areas where, you know, people are backslapping each other and making deals and smiling and drinking espressos. I mean, there's hundreds of booths and everyone has its own little espresso stand. And, you know, it feels like a business convention, not like a sort of a life or death crisis that they're talking about. And I walk out of there sometimes with tears in my eyes. And I had that yesterday when I was talking to the protesters after that demonstration. You know, I'm supposed to be a reporter and I'm supposed to keep a distance and, you know, and be calm and cool and rational about it. But it hits me really hard, and I feel it. I feel it.
For the past 14 years, Alex Wise has presented Sea Change Radio weekly on nonprofit radio stations and from the website www.seachange.net. That's the letter C, change.net. This is Great Green Radio. You can get the rest of this interview with reporter Bob Berwin at seachange.net or use links in my show blog. You will find more surprising truth from COP later in this program. Spoiler alert, our speaker is an American politician. We don't usually allow those. And double alert, he delivers the real stuff, things I did not know. And that makes a slight case for hope. But first, let's get to our scientific interview. As four typhoons roared across the Philippines and South China Sea, new science from NOAA predicts erratic extreme hurricane seasons ahead.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Climate change means surprises. New science suggests we may be fooled by quiet hurricane years, then hit by a terrible storm season, complete with massive damage and loss of lives. That strange new reality comes from a study just published in Science Advances. Projected increase in the frequency of extremely active Atlantic hurricane seasons. Here to explain is the lead author, Dr. Josme Lopez. Josme is an oceanographer working at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. He researches extreme weather and is a team leader for a NOAA project that develops a seasonal outlook for U.S. landfalling hurricanes. I look at that every year. From Florida, Josme Lopez, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to your audience.
Well, what brought you into the study of hurricanes, or as scientists prefer to call them, tropical cyclones?
Hurricanes are among the most deadly and costly natural disasters that impact our nation, as well as other countries, this year. So, therefore, there is an urgent need to better understand how hurricanes' activity are projected to change in the 21st century under the influence of anthropogenic climate change, or global warming, as you might have known.
And what did you and your six co-authors try to find out with this latest research?
In this work, we analyze observed changes in Atlantic hurricane activity, as well as their future projections. We show with this work that there has been a significant increase in the year-to-year variability of hurricane activity since around 1995. Which has been responsible for the occurrence of extremely active as well as extremely inactive hurricane seasons. Interesting with this work is that climate models also show this trend going into the future. So this suggests that, our work suggests that by the middle of the 21st century, the variability of hurricane activity will increase by an additional 36%. This increase in the future activity will cause more extreme swings between active and inactive hurricane seasons, with great implication for seasonal outlooks as well as for society.
And yet, if I have this right, at 2 degrees C of warming, for example, storm experts and the models predict there may be two fewer tropical cyclones per year if you take it on average, but some storm years would be much worse.
Correct. The scientific consensus at the moment is that a 2-degree global mean temperature increase will result in a reduction in hurricane frequency by about 15% for the Atlantic Basin. This accounts more or less for about 2 storms per year less than what we have seen in the historical period. But this reduction of 2 storms per year is much smaller than what we're already seeing in, as a year-to-year variability. For example, 2005, we saw 28 named storms, whereas in 2014, we only saw 8 named storms. So the current variability is much larger than the projected mean increase or decrease in hurricane activity. Despite this large year-to-year fluctuation, future changes in hurricane activity when it comes to year-to-year variability is rarely investigated. So this is one of the first studies that look into that.
And would some hurricanes be stronger in a warming world? Would they come in strings or even several at the same time? How do you picture the bad storm years in coming decades?
Most of the future projections call for an increase in hurricane intensity globally by about 5%. Not only that, but the impact, for example, when it comes to rainfall, some of these future projections call for an increase in rainfall associated, or rain rate associated with these storms by up to 15%. So while they may be less storms, the storm will be stronger. There's a disproportionate impact of strong storms versus weak storms. So it's not much more about the number of storms, but rather how intense they are.
It sounds like a hotter world brings many years of relative quiet on the storm front, and people in hurricane zones might relax and rebuild. Is it going too far to say that safety will be interrupted by storms stronger than we have seen, or a barrage of strong hurricanes? Is that how you would describe it?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement. For example, in our work, we found that by the middle of the 21st century, active hurricane seasons would account for about 38% of the years, whereas inactive hurricane season would be about 35% of the time, and the near normal seasons would only account for around 27% of the time. At the present time, the way we define what is an active, inactive, or normal hurricane season is based on climatological, what we call terciles. So we split the climatology into three beings, 33% each. So as you may recall from our work, we find that the inactive hurricane season as well as very active hurricane season will increase at the expense of near normal seasons.
You say tropical cyclone activity is partly forced by changes in the Pacific Ocean. Please explain how sea surface temperatures in the eastern Pacific, say down along Peru, can affect the hurricane season over the Caribbean and the American South.
The tropical Pacific hosts the most dominant and far-reaching climate mode or climate factor known, which is what we call El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO, which is an oscillation between warm and cold sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific. And the warm phase is known as El Niño, and what it does is this warm blob of sea surface temperatures reduces atmospheric convection over the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. And at the same time, it also increases the vertical wind shear or variation in wind speed and direction with height. Both effects are very detrimental for hurricane activity in the Atlantic basin. The opposite effect is observed during the cold phase, or known as La Niña, where you have reduction in the wind shear and more atmospheric instability over the Atlantic basin and increasing in hurricane activity there.
So with El Niño, we would expect fewer hurricanes in the Atlantic and Caribbean, and with La Niña, we might expect more.
Correct. And that is only one aspect. The Atlantic Basin itself is also a major driver of its own hurricane activity. So it's a combination of Atlantic as well as Pacific, so what we call interbasin interactions.
In a 2022 paper, you found changes in the way El Niño itself operates as the planet warms, and a recent paper published September 2024 in Nature agrees, this time with paleoclimate records. What do these changes in El Niño suggest about changes in the hurricane activity in the Atlantic?
Yes, our 2022 paper was the main motivation for this hurricane paper that we just published. In that paper in 2022, we found that El Niño variability will increase. Not only that, but also most of the increase in El Niño variability will occur during what we call the boreal summer, so our summer month, which is right in the middle of the hurricane season. So an increase in the major driver of seasonal hurricane activity will also increase the hurricane activity itself. So that was the hypothesis behind our work. And what we found is that this El Niño amplification, when it comes to the year-to-year variation, reflects onto a variation in hurricane activity in the Atlantic as well.
Osme, do you think global warming has already affected Atlantic hurricanes?
There's many recent stories arguing that changes in hurricane activity are detectable in the present day, with anthropogenic effects having already emerged over natural variability. However, separating natural versus anthropogenic modulation remains a challenge. This is mostly because as a natural forcing, there are modes of climate variability that operate on even decadal timescales. For example, the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation and the Pacific Decadal Oscillations, they have very slow varying modes, which also projects onto hurricane activity. That coupled to the fact that the hurricane observations record is relatively short and very inhomogeneous in time. So the observing system has evolved and improved. So there could be some artificial trends in the observations as well. So there's a lot of moving parts in order to be able to really pinpoint exactly how much anthropogenic climate change has caused the increase.
And looking through storm records, it appears that the short, quick storms, just a day or two long, are increasing as we warm. Why don't you count them in your study?
Yes, this stems from what I just mentioned before. The observing records have improved significantly, first with the addition of new techniques, addition of satellite data, for example, new methods of extracting intensity from remote sensing, radar, satellites, which have improved throughout the years. So what we found is that in the recent record, most of the increase in the short duration storms, like the storms that are very weak and last for less than 2 days, are mostly due to improvement in the observing system rather than any underlying climate change. So we have to filter those out. So that is a way for us to filter any external factors that are not associated with climate change, but are instead associated with just us being able to observe these storms better.
Interesting. The tools changed so we can actually see there were more of them. Okay, now, one tool scientists use to measure tropical cyclones is called ACE, which stands for Accumulated Cyclone Energy. I looked into it. The math behind that calculation is beyond most of us. How does it help you understand current and future storms?
ACE measures the accumulated energy, as you mentioned, associated with a given storm, and it depends not only on the storm being present, but also on the intensity of the storm, because it's an index that is basically the square of the maximum wind speed, but also it is aggregated over time. So it depends on the duration of the storm. So a long duration storm that is also a Category 5 will have significant amount of ACE. So ACE is a good metric for characterizing how active a hurricane season is. It is also well correlated with other large-scale climate factors like El Niño, for example, which is often used as a seasonal predictor for hurricane activity. Another point that we like to use ACE is because ACE records are relatively reliable, dating back to 1970. And that the mention of the short-duration storms have little or no impact on the seasonal ACE, because by definition, those storms are very weak and did not last as long, so their contribution to ACE is, in effect, very, very small.
And although it's not on your beat, you must have noticed that four tropical cyclones struck the Philippines in just 10 days this November. They arrived late at the end of a relatively quiet season. Is that unusual? Could it be another sign of human-induced climate change?
Yes, that is very unusual, especially this year where the Northwest Pacific has been fairly quiet as a whole. And it is very difficult to have this many strong storms making landfall on the same region, especially during a very inactive year for that specific region. So I'm sure there's going to be more studies on that, although I'm not an expert on Western Pacific tropical cycles, but I know that future climate change calls for an increase in intensity in that region as well as and including rain rate and major categories.
Suppose I'm a disaster planner in Florida or Texas or just a resident near the coast in those states. What can we do with the results of your new study?
Yes, these results are very important for disaster planners as well as the public in general, because both the increasing variability and the shift towards more active and inactive hurricane season, like, for example, the hyperactive years of 2005 and 2020, are projected to become more common. So just focusing on mean average increase or decrease is not enough. And the increase in the seasonal variability suggests that we may be underestimating future impact of this extreme hurricane season. As a resident, I would say always tell this to every time I get interviewed is that it is better to be prepared at all times. I want to recall that 1992, for example, was a very quiet season, but it gave us Hurricane Andrew, one of the most destructive hurricanes that impacted our nation.